The pace of application growth is unbelievable right now, right? By some metrics, right, you know, we're going to have 750 million new applications over the next 3 years, more than the past 40 years of computing. So it's very difficult to predict what those applications are going to look like. For example, are they going to be accessing block storage, file storage, object storage? Are they going to be on-prem? Are they going to be distributed? And how do I move those, right? So what I think about, right, is that the value here is that you can now manage very complex infrastructure for applications of any kind with a very simple consolidated architecture.
Welcome to the All Things Ops podcast. On this show, we interview leaders in IT operations, DevOps, and AI ops about the ever-changing world of running an organization's technology. With our guests, we dive into things like, what does it mean to run large-scale IT infrastructures? How do you manage globally distributed operations? What are the complexities of hybrid IT? How can you best leverage automation? And last, but definitely not least, how do you keep an eye on things using monitoring and observability? This podcast is produced by CheckMK, the software of choice when it comes to monitoring business-critical IT systems. All right. Hi. Welcome, everybody, to a new episode of the All Things Ops podcast. We have a great guest today. My guest for today's episode is Lee Caswell. Lee is a veteran of the enterprise IT space. He started his career originally at GE and has served as a number of senior marketing and general management roles in the enterprise IT space, you might say, for companies such as Microsemi, NetApp, and VMware. I think he was at VMware twice, actually. And he's now the Senior Vice President of Product and Solutions Marketing at Nutanix. Very interesting company. Lee, it's great to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Elias, it's great to be here. So thanks for the invite.
All right, let's get started. Just tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, how did you get to where you are today?
Yeah, sure. You know, so my background, I think, is one that comes from a hardware background first into the software space over time. And you know, I think I forget who said it, like software is eating the world, right?
And Mark Andreessen
started actually, in semiconductors, ASICs. I was at Adaptec, as you mentioned, that eventually got purchased by Microsemi, but building subsystem like RAID and SCSI controllers. You know, back if you think back that far. Terrific background, actually, for thinking about, how the underlying systems of servers were built. And, you know, over time, right, I moved up into like add-in cards. That was Fusion IO, right? And a lot of history in Flash here, right? Then to NetApp, which is a systems company, right, on storage. And then to VMware, right, taking that, you know, storage background and looking at how to basically build a software platform on top of hardware. And then here today, right, building a full hybrid multi-cloud software platform, right, that spans across Kubernetes. I mean, all of a sudden, you know, it's been a terrific career of just learning new things, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. Great. We'll talk about what you do in a second, but it's funny that you mentioned it, that you know, hardware is sort of a good starting point. But in the end, you know, everything runs on some kind of hardware. You know, we might call it serverless. There's still a server there. We might call it the cloud. There's still, you know, it's not actually droplets in the sky. It's actually hardware running things. So in the end, it always comes down to that again, no matter how many layers of abstraction we put on top of it. But speaking of layers on top of hardware, Nutanix, tell us just briefly what Nutanix does.
Yeah, so Nutanix is a company that's now virtualized, as you mentioned, right? So really abstracting the hardware layer below it. So taking commodity servers, aggregating storage across those servers. We started off with servers that were on-prem, like in the data center. And then as the data center ceased to be the center of data, we then bridged out into the cloud, right? And so we run now on servers that you can rent or at the edge. And over time, we went from traditional VM applications now to supporting Kubernetes. And the application space, right, is that, you know, for us, new applications, including like Gen AI, is like the next wave of applications coming on. And so it's an incredibly exciting time to look at how software can bring new hardware value to customers.
Great. So Nutanix is all about, I mean, if I go to your website, it probably, I don't even need to scroll to read hyper-converged infrastructure about 17 times. What does that mean? What's a hyper-converged infrastructure?
Yeah, you know, for years, people talk about converging infrastructure as a way to simplify the management, because it turns out patching and provisioning is pretty tough if you have like a hypervisor and a the server itself and a SAN switch and a SAN system. It's, you know, these are complicated systems to go and manage independently. A little bit like the old days when you used to have a fax and a, you know, copier and a printer and a scanner. Remember, like all these were all different. And so what we've done at Nutanix is we've consolidated these together. And what makes it possible largely is flash. You know, for the very first time, storage latencies are lower than network latencies. And so what we're able to do is take servers, aggregate them together with standard Ethernet networking, aggregate the storage across those as a persistent store, and then have virtual machines that translate, you know, that basically float on the top of that. And that cloud platform then gives you a cloud operating model that can run on-prem or, as I said, in the public cloud or even out at the edge.
So here again, the importance between hardware and software is very important because we're talking about flash storage and not the flash player. I think nobody wants that back. All right. So as an organization, why do I want a hyper-converged infrastructure besides the fact that everything sounds cooler if you put hyper in front of it?
Yeah, no doubt. Here's why, right? So the pace of application growth is unbelievable right now, right? By some metrics, right? You know, we're going to have 750 million new applications over the next 3 years, more than the past 40 years of computing. So it's very difficult to predict what those applications are going to look like. For example, are they going to be accessing block storage, file storage, object storage? Are they going to be on-prem? Are they going to be distributed? And how do I move those, right? So what I think about, right, is that the value here is that you can now manage very complex infrastructure for applications of any kind with a very simple consolidated architecture. And that means one team, for example, right, can go and deploy databases, analytics, VDI, other applications, even Gen AI. And you can run them on-prem in the public cloud or out at the edge. That's a tremendous amount of operating leverage. There's one other thing I should add though, right, is that with security risks today, the ability to patch and provision the complete stack means that you can actually get to a protected security position exceptionally fast. And that's really important for customers thinking about how they basically, you know, survive in a world of increased threats and risks.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in line with the application growth, you mentioned the growth of cyber threats definitely is keeping pace with that. It's really interesting what you mentioned about sort of this growth and the dynamism. We can't really predict what things will run on in you know, what, even in 5 years' time. A little while ago, I read a book. It's called The Innovators, which is a great book about sort of the history of computer science, basically. And, you know, first you talk in decades of how things evolved. And now we're in a situation where, you know, Kubernetes, I think, was open sourced in 2015. And by 2021, 22, 23, it's the de facto infrastructure in which many people run anything that they build new. I mean, migration and re-architecting is a different story, but you know, going from something that is completely new in 2015 to it's the de facto standard in 5 years is pretty impressive.
I suggest on Kubernetes, for example, we believe that, you know, the industry has standard on Kubernetes as the way to make applications portable across this new hybrid cloud model. A lot of people initially thought like Kubernetes was going to be limited to the public cloud, right, and stateless containers. What they're finding is containerization is making its way on-prem as you basically containerize new applications to speed the pace of development, right, and eliminate OS dependencies. So we believe like Kubernetes, now the development environments are actually not standardized yet, right? You've got Red Hat OpenShift, there's EKSA, for example, Rancher, right? And so you've got different development environments, but you standardize on Kubernetes, and that's what allows portability. That's why Google open sourced it in part, right? It was to bring applications into GCP. Similarly, by the way, S3 is a standard for data portability across the hybrid multi-cloud environment. And so you'll see us looking at object storage and S3. And when I ask customers about, like, you know, how much object storage will you need in 3 years? People are like, I don't know. But do they think object storage will be important in 3 years? And the answer is always yes. So one of the things you want is a flexibility. These used to be separate architectures before Nutanix. You'd have an object store and you'd have a filer and you'd have like block storage. We've consolidated those all together so you can get all of them. And you can choose over time which one you want to go and use.
Depending on how your needs evolve.
Yeah. And it's all, life is the same, right? So that's one of the big values is customers don't have to predict, and it's very difficult to predict today.
The premise underpinning this HCI, hyperconverged infrastructure, seems to be that for the foreseeable future, we're talking large enterprises here, the infrastructures are going to be hybrid, point one, and that the cloud part of that hybrid setup is actually going to be living in multiple public clouds. Right now we have the big three. Is this something you would agree with? Do you see some major changes going on there? What's your take on this?
Yeah, it's a really insightful question, because I think where we're at today is, customers who went into the cloud, in many cases, were using PaaS level services from a specific cloud with the idea that those applications and that associated data would be, in that one cloud. And certainly moving data means that it's very expensive to move it out of a specific cloud, or can be, right? Now what's happening, though, is customers are starting to think, right, now that money's not free, and they're realizing like the cloud is, agile, but fairly expensive, right? And they're also realizing that their data centers aren't going away because of sovereignty, performance, and cost reasons. Now they're starting to look first at hybrid. And we define hybrid as going from a data center or an edge, right, to a single cloud. And then multi-cloud, we're calling going across clouds. And I think we're actually at the start of hybrid cloud, and multi-cloud is still a future element where people will start thinking, for applications that don't require the PaaS level services of a specific provider, I may want to move them across, or I may want to move that data and application, move the data across to go and get like analytics applied from a different cloud, or move it on-prem, right? And that idea of portability, or for DR purposes, or even for bursting level, that is a new way to go and think about the access that you want to take advantage of what's in the public cloud at the same time that you want to preserve the privacy, sovereignty, day two operations, and control of enterprise applications you run on-prem.
Mm-hmm. So the way you talk about this, it sounds like people are putting a lot of thought into this. However, when we talked last time, what you said, the reality often is, people find themselves, and you called it accidental hybrid multi-cloud environments. What did you mean by that? And that doesn't sound as thoughtful as what you just laid out. That sounds much more, oh crap, what did we do here?
I was liking it the other day to it, like after a holiday dinner, you ask your kids to fill up the dishwasher and they do it really fast, but then you're like, hey, like we got a lot more dishes left over. And if I go and reorganize this a little bit, I can fit a lot more dishes in and run it. That's kind of where we're at, I think, the fast speed of having applications in this cloud and some in this cloud, right? And some over here meant we had multiple clouds, but not what we call multi-cloud. Mm-hmm. And multi-cloud means there's a common operating model across these clouds. It's super important from a data perspective, because that means now that I can manage the data, protect the data, and really importantly, I can restore the data, right? So we have these snapshots, for example, and that's about taking snapshots of data, which is good. That's what you want that. But what's really important is how fast is it to restore? So if you can restore data exactly the same way across files, blocks, objects, VMs, containers, on-prem, in the public cloud, it's a great simplifying solve for having one team that can manage things independent. And so that's where customers are starting to look and say, if I could integrate these, I could actually have a more powerful network. And effectively, Nutanix could be the edge for every hyperscaler.
I just had to laugh about your dishwasher example, kind of a personal anecdote from my side. Yeah. So my dad, when he started his career, he worked for a sort of consumer goods conglomerate that also does dishwasher detergent. And I think he was like working in that department. So they actually had to take a course. Part of the training was like loading a dishwasher, right? So which obviously led to the fact that whenever we loaded the dishwasher, we were doing it wrong. And then he would like
play this game of Tetris to get at least one single plate more into the dishwasher than we were able to, just to prove that I took a course of this. I know how this is done. So much for re-architecting the dishwasher.
You can imagine now, right? This gives new power and control, really, opportunity for the infrastructure builder today to say, hey, listen, if we start looking carefully, just like, you know, you're coming over as a supervisor to this thinking, you know, if we do this, maybe these applications don't need to be in the, shouldn't be in the cloud. They should be on-prem. Or maybe this application, right, should be moved from this cloud to this cloud. And, you know, Nutanix is really, you know, one of only a few players that are interested in moving data across clouds. You won't find the hyperscalers interested in that. So the idea that you could do this in a new thoughtful way means that what we're encouraging customers to do is classify your applications and your data so they're optimally located. And we can help you basically make sure they're going to be, you're able to move them, right, when you actually get to that step.
Yeah, and I mean, this is I think, a common theme that you see in every field, be it development, be it system engineering, that people are attracted by shiny new objects and say, hey, right, we should do everything serverless now, whether that makes sense or not for that particular use case is a separate question. And Brian, I don't know if you've seen this. If not, you should look it up on YouTube. There's a video where they do a voice overlay of a clip from Seinfeld, where Kramer wants to move everything. I think it's like a baseball trading card side to Kubernetes, and service mesh, and basically Seinfeld saying, "You sure about that?" It's very, very funny. But let's come back to these multi-cloud environments. Now, let's imagine I'm a CIO. I start a new job in a good sizable company, and I inherit one of those accidental hybrid multi-cloud environments. So it's not thoughtfully put out. What is sort of your pitch to introduce yet another layer of tools and infrastructure and abstraction to that mix, to that dishwasher, rather than, you know, starting by trying to consolidate things? Is it okay, let's get rid of GCP and Azure and consolidate everything in AWS? That'll already simplify things. So why take that route and say, well, we'll live with the multi-cloud and try to manage it better, rather than no, let's, you know, these are largely comparable, let's move everything, let's decide on one and consolidate everything there to simplify things?
Yeah. So job one, when we talk to CIOs today, is to modernize your on-prem environment to a server-based software-defined architecture. That's first. Most systems today still remain what we call classic three-tier architectures in an on-prem environment. So that would be a separate server, virtualized, normally with VMware, right? Attached to, you know, there's a LAN, of course, but they also have a dedicated storage network, usually Fibre Channel SAN, right? These are all proprietary hardware elements. So the very first step to being ready for a hybrid multi-cloud environment is to standardize on servers. And, you know, we talk a little bit about how the importance, and this is where a hardware background comes in really useful, right? Is, you know, the volume of servers. If you want new technology, the fastest way to get it is through new commodity servers, because, you know, there's 27,000 servers, by my calculation, sold every day. 27,000. And the reason for that, the cloud is built on servers, not proprietary hardware. It's built on servers. And that scale out server model means if you want the latest CPUs from Intel or AMD, if you want the latest GPUs from NVIDIA, for example, you want the latest NVMe devices from all the, you know, the leading providers, or even the network technologies, they come to servers. And with Nutanix, you can feather those into your existing environment seamlessly, right? So you have a cluster of, let's say, pick a number, right? 10, 12 nodes. You can now take new hardware, bring it in. You can decommission old nodes. So you've got this way to go and accelerate the adoption of new technology. Now, once you have a server-based system in your on-prem data center, now you've got the opportunity to extend to the hybrid cloud where it's still based on servers, and you're running our common stack there. And so, and for many customers, right, that's the natural evolution, right, is to say, I'm going to go now and basically be future-proofed to move into the cloud of my choice. Today, we support Azure and AWS, for example. And so you can see that how that works. Does that make sense to you? I mean,
And that was sort of the question that I was going for next, and you almost answered that, or you answered it to a large part. It's like, you know, I can see the obvious benefit once this thing is fully fleshed out, but the road to get there seems pretty daunting. And I was about to ask you sort of what's a good starting point. You mentioned what is a good starting point, you know, get everything to a server-based infrastructure, software-defined infrastructure, rather than having proprietary hardware solutions for things.
Yeah. You know, it's actually very similar to the way that x86 came into the Unix market. Mm-hmm. Listen, Unix works great. I mean, you know, if you were a Spark or AIX or HPUX systems, I mean, they did everything you needed to do, except, you know, they were, proprietary hardware is very expensive to buy. It took people, you know, 18 months to become experts, and they were expert on one of those, not in multiple ones. And so x86 came in, and basically all the new applications went on x86, and people contained their investment in the older Unix systems. And because the apps are actually quite difficult to replatform, those even still exist today, right? As you can see,
right? They do.
People, they bleed them off over time as best they can. But everything new went on these x86 servers. That was the compute virtualization wave. The same thing's happening with HCI now, right? Mm-hmm. HCI came in to go and take the base level applications first, right? And now is taking on the highest performance databases, analytics, Gen AI. And so you're basically putting everything new and kind of capping those investments as they bleed down over time. And you think, well, those SAN investments that I have, fiber channel investments, I'm not going to throw them away, but you basically constrain the investment on those. And with the search for talent being what it is, you basically get generalists to go and run this new infrastructure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you don't find yourself in the same situation that whatever the large banks find themselves, that they look for, you know, 80-year-old COBOL programmers to run their core, to kind of fix their core banking systems. That has a kind of a natural expiry date, how long you can do that, because, you know, very few of those will want to work, especially at the rate that they're paid. You know, they probably don't need to work anymore at 80. they will surely won't work until they're 100. So there's some natural, but yeah, I mean, you mentioned they were. I actually talked to a customer of ours where, well, we, you know, for us, it's about monitoring these systems, and they have, you know, applications based on Oracle databases that run on AIX. And it's kind of core to what they do. You know, they run their finance systems and so on that. So it's not like something that you just, you know, change like your underwear. They know they need to get out of that at some point, or they want to. But I think they're also very good at pushing off that point into the future.
There's an interesting management construct change also, right? So when you're managing discrete systems and something happens, let's say there's a performance issue with your application in a, you know, older system where you've got separate storage and a, you know, a switch guy. I mean, you bring everybody in, you bring the network guy, the application guy, you know, the storage person. And generally you go to the network guy first and say, what happened? Like, what did you change? Right now you have your best people looking to try and understand the complex interaction of these distributed, distinct, separate systems. It's a very complicated process to understand what happened around performance, for example, which is actually key to, you know, being competitive these days, right? And so in an HCI system, it's actually quite different. What you do is you're looking at a VM out level, which means you're looking from the VM, you're looking at all the attributes that an application is experiencing. So I can look at RAM and CPU and network utilization, and I can go and actually change those, right, on the fly. And so it's a very, it's a more application-centric method of doing performance diagnostics, of basically looking at anything you have to do with security. And so that's actually a very, you know, it leads to speed. So just like you talked about, like, you know, how do you get the hardware out of the way so that you can get back to the job of infrastructure, which at the end of the day is to protect your data and speed the deployment of applications. Mm-hmm. And that's where HCI and what Nutanix does helps.
On one of the previous episodes of this podcast, we talked about, because you mentioned two things in one sentence, security and speed. And yeah, often that's a perceived trade-off, and security seems like a tax on anything you do to speed up things. And you know, talk to like performance engineers, they're like, well, you know, we want to make things fast,
right,
but at an appropriate level of security. Right. How do you balance these two, and how do you make sure that it doesn't go overboard one way or the other?
Right. Well, you can almost think of the security space as one that's in runaway today, right? I mean, people are spending more on discrete products to try and protect things and still getting hacked more. So yeah, it's not converging, right? You know, so the idea that you can have integrated security across all the elements of infrastructure today. So within the storage, for example, you know, security for data at rest, for security of data in flight on the network level, right? To have micro segmentation, to have protect east west traffic, right? And eliminate the exposure profile, right? Or the, security, risk across, you know, presuming someone gets inside the perimeter. And you started thinking about it in those terms. Now I've got the opportunity to go and have an integrated plan, number one. The second one is this, right? When you have issues like Log4j or other things, right, that come out and, you know, make the news around how fast you need to go and upgrade. The thing is that, you know, just like on your phone, I mean, I don't have to upgrade my camera independently of my, flashlight or whatever, right? I mean, I integrate everything all at once. And so that idea really means that I can get back to a protected state a lot more quickly. And so that's how we think about it. Oh, mm-hmm. one last thing, right? You know, when you think about extending to the hybrid cloud, like the first question should be, wait a minute, what about the security of my data center? Am I exposing myself to what's happening in the public cloud? So, you know, that's really important in terms of how we're architecting this. So the way we do this is we run on bare metal instances inside of AWS and Azure, and then we're integrated with the networking stack so that we have an extended VPC from on-prem into the public cloud. So that means you're able to bring your own security policies to the public cloud portion that's running Nutanix. And now I've got basically a protected state. And those apps, by the way, can extend and access all of the underlying cloud assets that I've got, but they're protected from your existing security profile. I mean, these are the sort of things you start thinking about when you think about, well, how do I build this hybrid multi-cloud environment in a thoughtful, you know, forethought way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That does make sense. And we see this sort of in our domain, which is monitoring quite a bit as well, where some of the things that worked very well in one state, in a purely on-prem environment, you have to care about different things than if you are in a cloud-only environment or in a hybrid environment. And you know, we also need to change our approach on how we monitor, for example, certain assets, because you might not want the traffic flowing that way, but it's better if it flows the other way and things like that. So I totally see what you're saying, sort of looking at it with a monitoring and observability lens as well.
It's also interesting to extend that into like modern applications that are container-based and Kubernetes orchestrated. I mean, Kubernetes doesn't have an inherent security profile by itself. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of how do you provide that? So this is one of the things that we're offering, is to say you can treat, you know, containers with exactly the same level of security and even data services. So snapshot, replication, DR that you have for traditional VMs. And so that gives you a level of kind of day two operation compliance that we think is really required for the enterprise application of Kubernetes for the traditional enterprise apps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The whole Kubernetes or container security space is quite interesting. And I had another podcast episode, I think three or four episodes back, where we talked about that and how an emergent field that is. And where a lot of organizations haven't figured that part out entirely yet. They jumped to Kubernetes and then security became an afterthought. Like, oh, I guess we got to think about security differently. I interrupted you.
No. Well, I'm going to say that it's one of the reasons we just acquired a company called D2IQ. Many would remember them as Mesosphere, right? Was, a team that was really focused on management of containers at very large scale. And you'll see us bring that capability into the Nutanix cloud platform for a way to extend that value while preserving, by the way we work with companies like Red Hat and OpenShift, right, from a clear developer standpoint. And so it's going to be very interesting because we think and believe, right, that Kubernetes, as I mentioned, will be the standard for portability of applications. And so, you know, that basically being able to manage those with the same kind of infrastructure value that you've had typically, day two operations, compliance, right, security. So it's going to be exceptionally important, right, to go and offer customers as they build this integrated environment.
For sure. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about a different stage in your career. You were with VMware for a number of years. You were there twice. Yeah. Now, obviously, you know, if you work in enterprise IT, it's hard to miss that VMware is getting a lot of press, not all of that good, or not much of it very good right now, after the acquisition by Broadcom. Do you have any thoughts of how things will shake out? Will VMware remain the de facto standard for virtualization of servers? Is there a tectonic shift to other solutions, other hypervisors and these kind of things? Or is it, as they say in German, nothing is eaten as hot as it is cooked. And there's a lot of...
Do they say that?
Yeah. It's a German... I'm German, so I sometimes use like Germanisms. But I've learned that not everything translates that well. But basically, you know, the saying, there's a lot of obviously noise right now because there's a lot of things happening, you know, with products being deprecated and whatnot. But sort of, if once the dust settles, will the virtualization landscape look very different or just a little bit different?
Yeah, it's really, I mean, and I know, you know, for customers, this is a very serious issue, right? I mean,
you know, we're talking millions of dollars here.
Well, billions actually, right? So, you know, Broadcom's stated objective is to nearly double the profitability of VMware from $4.7 to $8.5 billion. Right, that's $3.8 billion that's going to come from somewhere. So most customers are expecting to pay more. They're just finding out how it's going to happen. That's the first step, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, in terms of how that's going to happen, you know, there's some kind of classic, we call it Broadcom plays in place, right? They're shrinking the number of SKUs. And, you know, customers who were buying individual products are now buying more bundled products. You could argue that that's more value for customers. And for some, that's, you know, could be true. But there's also the risk, right, that customers will essentially pay more, right? And customers are going through that process right now to understand that. It's also very disruptive, actually, for the partner community. So the partner community, these are channel partners, right? And VMware has over 20,000 sellers, right, or channel partners, where, you know, the top 2,000 customers, for example, are being taken direct. So that's changing a lot of the dynamics. So there's a lot of churn, as you mentioned, right? A lot of chatter around it. I think this, though, you know, that VMware has built fantastic products, fantastic company, by the way. You know, I've got lots of friends there. I've had a great experience there myself. And, you know, their, you know, early work in the hypervisor, compute hypervisor, was really, you know, extraordinary. And you know that in the past, right, you know, with Hyper-V, for example, or even Zen Server, alternatives were offered even for free and customers didn't change because robust feature set and the way that customers were trained and familiar with vCenter, they didn't really have a compelling reason to change in an enterprise environment. You know, by my calculation, that's changing in some sense and will remain the same in others. I'll start with what's remaining the same. You know, for people who have built-in SAN and storage, you know, classic storage investments, they're not going to throw those away. I mean, what I was talking about, that I was just in Dubai, right? I'm saying, you know, if the price of gas goes up 3x, you don't throw away your gas car. That's not what you do. But you may start thinking more carefully about where you use it and start thinking about electric, you know, an electric car vehicle over time, right? We'd be the electric vehicle in that example, right? If I want to modernize, and how would I do that over time? So I think, you know, that for customers, they're struggling a little bit with the fact that they're probably going to pay more for some period of time for their existing investments. And then they'll figure out how to go and work, you know, with Nutanix. They'll actually look at the cloud too, for how do you build new things and where do you build them? We think the value of retaining your on-prem environment connected to the hybrid multi-cloud is more powerful than trying to actually just exit the data center and go to the public cloud. We think that's the more likely. Data people believe distributed data will be the future. And so we're really encouraged, right, about customers coming to us, particularly very large scale, long-term VMware customers saying, hey, we're going to look at what we could do with you, right? Even though we know we can't get out of the hypervisor only environment right away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that this is, I think, true for other similar things. It's not going to, I mean, we're talking about, you know, ginormous infrastructures with tens of thousands hundreds of thousands of machines. You don't, you know, change that like your underwear, just, you know, and the switching cost is enormous, and the risk that you assume in, like, you know, tinkering with something that works well. So I think, but I do see quite a bit of, you know, all, again, from our monitoring perspective, where we get more questions of, hey, you know, how's your monitoring for Proxmox or for Nutanix, right, or fill in the blank, you know, Hyper-V. It's tangible, and I'm very interested to see how things shake out and a year, 18 months from now.
I'd say, you know, from a hypervisor standpoint only, like if you take our hypervisor in an environment, you know, compare it with ESXi, for example, I think you're going to find that, you know, we're virtually identical from a compatibility standpoint and from, you know, application standpoint. And that's really, you know, the hypervisor has become a commodity. We have a KVM-based hypervisor, which is what every modern cloud uses. And so, you know, from a hypervisor standpoint, I think really the question is, I can't just throw away ESXi and go to AHV today. I have to go and move to a server-based infrastructure. So if you've done that already, what we're finding is customers are accelerating that transition. That's good news, right? If you haven't done that, what we're encouraging customers is get started, find a way, you know, if you want to run, let's say, a test dev environment with our product, get familiar with it, you know, see what the alternatives are. If you want to run us as a DR target, you can do that where ESXi continues to run in the primary. We could be the target for that. If you want to run a new Gen AI system, we've got an announced something called GPT in a box, which allows you to take GPU enabled clusters from Nutanix. We'll help you build out a support Copilot or a, you know, intelligent chatbot or a video detection fraud system or something. So we can help you get accelerated. Start with the new things. And as I mentioned, this is exactly how x86 got started, right? Is, gosh, I'll go get started. I'll get familiar with it. And then what I realize is, hey, this is not just as good. It's actually better. And it allows me to go and do more things without having to plan as far in advance, because I can support files, blocks, objects, right? Containers, VMs. It gives me all the degrees of freedom I'm likely to need over time.
All right. That seems like a good point to sort of end the serious part of the conversation.
There we go.
We talk about sort of the large world of enterprise IT. And we always end these interviews on sort of a lighthearted sort of blast from the past. And the question I always ask myself is, how old were you when you started dabbling with computers? And how old were you when you broke your first computer?
Wow. So this is going to date myself probably a little bit, right? So, you know.
Well, you don't have to name the model. You can just say I was 17 years old, which was about 10 years ago.
I'm going to say APL 360. I had the first, you know, remember the APL, well, you may not, but APL 360 primers. I grew up in Poughkeepsie, New York, right? IBM town. And so you could actually go in and do time sharing at the local IBM branches, right? For IBM kids. And so anyway, that was my first one. The first one I broke. And my dad was an IBM manage some of the research there. So we have computers at home. And so probably kind of embarrassing, but a friend and I, like in high school, writing some sort of dating app or something and forgot it didn't have any, it didn't have non-volatile memory. So we had plugged it into the light switch and so we were going out to dinner and the light switch was connected to the power. So we had spent maybe 3 hours like writing some ridiculous thing and went off, turned off the lights as we went off and the computer turned off and all of it was lost.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it wasn't really broken, but you just
lost
your work. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Well, that'll teach you. I guess I'm probably, your dad was probably glad that you didn't actually break it and just maybe learned a valuable lesson.
Exactly.
Now, I know that the answer to this is obviously never black or white for most people, but there's, especially like in the light of what we just talked about with VMware and alternatives, is I have the impression that this debate got a little more steam again. It's like open source or closed source. Do you want to work with proprietary tools or is open source the panacea for everything that plagues this industry? The answer is not black or white, but if I make you pick, which way are you leaning?
Well, so just like we're encouraging customers to tap into the cloud because it's powerful, but don't forget the value that infrastructure owners bring, right, around day two compliance and day two operations and compliance and security and others, right, is that you want to tap into open source where you can, right, where it's valuable, where you can speed things up, right? And so this is really important, we feel, right? And so we've tapped into KVM, for example, right, from a hypervisor standpoint and other open source areas. So I believe the access to open source is really important. But what you find, right, when you get to enterprise is that it starts to blend a little bit. Postgres, by the way, is another great example in the database space, right? Doubled the users of Postgres on our system is now 45%, which is quite stunning, right?
Yeah.
I think what you start to look at is use open source where you can for speed, and then figure out and make sure that you've got all the security, day two operations, and compliance that is that you're going to be held accountable for.
Yeah, for sure. Now, obviously, usually your company makes you choose one of these, but if you can choose for yourself, are you Linux or your Mac or your Windows guy?
This is embarrassing. My daughter's a data scientist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, so she's a Windows person and I'm a marketing person these days. And so I have a Mac. And so
you fulfill the cliche.
Exactly. And I used a Mac because actually at home, that meant that I didn't have to be the system admin.
I don't know how to do this. I only know how to work a Mac.
I had the Genius Bar to go to, right? So
Okay.
That was I was offloading support actually, in the home environment. So today it's Mac.
Yeah. All right. Well, great. This was fun. We took quite a large tour through the world of infrastructure and how we got here and where this is going. This was awesome. Thank you so much.
Always exciting and really fun. So thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the All Things Ops podcast. If you like this episode, leave us a review and subscribe on your favorite podcast player. This podcast has been brought to you by CheckMK. For more resources, head over to checkmk.com/podcast. If you want to send us feedback or suggest a guest, please drop us an email at podcast@checkmk.com. Until next time, happy monitoring.